Chapter 10. A Signal from the Dreamtime? Skoglund and Reich's paper in Nature, reporting the presence of Australasian genes in certain populations in the Amazon, is titled Genetic Evidence for Two Founding Populations of the Americas. It was first published online on July 21, 2015, ahead of the print edition, which appeared on September 3, 2015. On precisely the same day, before appearing in print in the journal Science on August 21, 2015, another team of researchers, led by Manasa Raghavan and Eske Willislev, both of the Center for Geogenetics at the University of Copenhagen, published the online version of a paper titled Genomic Evidence for the Pleistocene and Recent Population History of Native Americans. Unlike Skoglund and Reich, who see two founder populations in the data, Raghavan and Willislev see only one, arriving in a single migration wave from Siberia no earlier than 23,000 years ago, and after no more than an 8,000-year isolation period in Beringia. Raghavan and Willislev several times drive home the point that the data they present are consistent with a single initial migration of all Native Americans along a route from Siberia via Beringia, and that from that single migration there was a diversification of ancestral Native Americans leading to the formation of northern and southern branches. This is all very neat, tidy, and in certain ways reassuring for those American archaeologists, a majority, still reeling from post-traumatic shock following the collapse of the Clovis First dogma. Of course, they would have to be in a state of rigid and unyielding denial to continue to shrug off the perfect storm of evidence from genetics and from sites like Topper, Cactus Hill, and Monteverde that relegated Clovis to the trash can of history. But at least their favored route from Siberia across the Bering Land Bridge remains intact, and not only that, but Raghavan and Willislev's paper also endorses the currently fashionable Beringian standstill model. If only the geneticists had ended their paper there, archaeological contentment with it would have been complete. However, because they're good scientists, Raghavan and Willislev, just like Skoglund and Reich, could not ignore the persistent Australasian signal that kept cropping up in the data. We found that some American populations, including Aleutian Islanders, Surui, and Athabascans, are closer to Australo-Melanesians as compared with other Native Americans such as North American Ojibwa, Cree, and Algonquin, and the South American Purépecha, Arhuaco, and Wayuu. The Surui are, in fact, one of the closest Native American populations to East Asians and Australo-Melanesians, the latter including Papuans, non-Papuan Melanesians, Solomon Islanders, and Southeast Asian hunter-gatherers such as Aieta. As we've heard in previous chapters, the archaeological mainstream is an intensely conservative and territorial scholarly community, resistant to change, whose deeply embedded prejudices deny that our Stone Age ancestors could have possessed anything other than the most primitive and rudimentary technological abilities. For Orthodox thinkers, it is literally inconceivable that prehistoric settlers from the general vicinity of Papua New Guinea could have crossed the entire width of the Pacific Ocean to South America and thence made their way to the Amazon to leave evidence of their presence in the DNA of people still living there today. What's paradoxical about this position is that, admittedly after a hard-fought struggle, no one in the mainstream would now seriously dispute that our ancient hominid ancestors were capable of undertaking successful open-water voyages to colonize new lands. We've seen how the presence of Denisovan DNA on both sides of the Timor Straits and both east and west of Wallace's line confirms that migrations across stretches of open water up to 90 kilometers wide were indeed taking place at least 60,000 years ago. A position already supported by a mass of other evidence. Likewise, and significantly earlier, bones and artifacts of Homo erectus, dated to 800,000 years before the present, have been found on the Indonesian islands of Flores and Timor, again making open water crossings by these supposed subhumans a certainty, even during periods of lowered sea level. All this has long ago been conceded. Despite the passage of close to a million years since Homo erectus first sailed to Flores, however, what archaeology does not concede is that the human species could have developed and refined those early nautical skills to the extent of being able to cross a vast ocean like the Pacific or the Atlantic from one side to the other. In the case of the former, extensive transoceanic journeys are not believed to have been undertaken until about 3,500 years ago during the so-called Polynesian expansion. And the mainstream historical view is that the Atlantic was not successfully navigated until 1492, the year in which, as the schoolyard mnemonic has it, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Indeed, the notion that long transoceanic voyages were a technological impossibility during the Stone Age remains one of the central structural elements of the dominant reference frame of archaeology. A reference frame that geneticists see no reason not to respect and deploy when interpreting their own data. Since that reference frame rules out a priori the option of a direct ocean crossing between Australasia and South America during the Paleolithic, and instead is adamant that all settlement came via Northeast Asia, geneticists tend to approach the data from that perspective. This is the case with Raghavan and Willislev. First, as we've seen, they concede the presence within the data of a distinct Old World signal related to Australo-Melanesians and East Asians in some Native Americans. But second, they go on to downplay the implications of this with the following interpretation. The widely scattered and differential affinity of Native Americans to the Australo-Melanesians, ranging from a strong signal in the Surui to a much weaker signal in northern Amerindians such as Ojibwa, points to this gene flow occurring after the initial peopling by Native American ancestors. Here's how they arrive at this interpretation of the data. 1. They trace the source of the strong Australasian signal in the Amazon to gene flow, the transfer of genetic variation from one population to another. 2. They propose that this gene flow reached Amazonian peoples such as the Surui from northern Amerindian populations such as the Aleutian Islanders and the Athabascans, and they appear to favor particularly a route via the Aleutian Islanders, since the latter were previously found to be closely related to the Inuit, who have a relatively greater affinity to East Asians, Oceanians, and Denisovans than Native Americans. They hypothesize that the complex genetic history of the Aleutian Islanders perhaps included input from a population related to Australo-Melanesians through an East Asian continental route, in other words, from Siberia across the Bering Land Bridge, and this genomic signal might have been subsequently transferred to parts of the Americas, including South America, through past gene flow events. The problem I have with all this is that these hypothetical past gene flow events somehow left a strong DNA signal in the Amazon, one of the remotest and most inaccessible parts of South America, while leaving next to no signal at all in North America, which, whether the genes were carried by people who traveled on foot or by people who island-hopped and coasted from the Aleutians in simple watercraft, would surely have involved interactions with North American populations before any interactions with South American populations took place, and therefore presumably should have left a DNA signal in North America at least as strong as the signal found in the Amazon. Seeking clarification, I contacted Professor Willislev directly at the University of Copenhagen on March 2, 2018, and asked what in his data had led him and his co-authors to conclude that the gene flow bringing the Australasian signal to the Amazon had occurred after the initial peopling of the Americas. I also asked why they favored Aleutian Islanders as the likely vector, and whether it was not counterintuitive to propose such an extreme northern source for this gene flow. If a northern source had indeed been involved, I argued, then wouldn't we expect to see a decline in the signal from strongest in the north, near the putative source, to weakest in the faraway south, and particularly in remote South American regions like the Amazon? But my understanding of the data is that if there is a decline at all, it is in the opposite direction, in other words, from strongest in the south to weakest in the north. Am I understanding correctly? And if so, how do you explain this counterintuitive Klein? Are we to imagine Aleutians or Athabascans island hopping and coasting down the entire Pacific coast of North America, absolutely not intermingling with anyone else or leaving any DNA traces along the way, until they arrive, presumably, at some point on the Pacific coast of South America, whence they strike inland for the Amazon? Professor Willislev replied, "When you talk about a Klein in contemporary data, you assume peoples have stayed in the same place since the Pleistocene. We do not know that. Therefore, I don't think it's a particularly good argument. A lot of stuff can happen over tens of thousands of years in regard to distribution of peoples. In principle, the signal in the north could have been lost by replacement. We simply don't know." "Dear Eske," I responded. Happily, we had agreed to switch to first name terms. "I take your point absolutely on all of this, and I certainly don't imagine that peoples have stayed in the same places since the Ice Age. It's part of the essence of being human, I think, to move around, migrate, and explore. Still, will I be misrepresenting the facts if I were to state in my book, with reference specifically to present-day populations, that a Klein of the Australasian signal is evident, with a stronger signal in South America, particularly the Amazon, than anywhere in North America? And further, again with reference specifically to present-day populations, would I be misrepresenting the facts to say that the Australasian signal is stronger amongst the Surui than it is amongst the Aleutians and Athabascans, and that the Surui's affinity to East Asians, Oceanians, and Denisovans is stronger than that of the Inuit?" "No," Eske replied. "I would not call it a Klein. It's strongest in the Surui, but stronger in Aleutians than in Athabascans. But these groups also contain more East Asian, so it may simply reflect just that. The Denisovan signal is not stronger in the Surui than in the others, to my knowledge. In summary, therefore, taking into account all of the above, the situation seems to be that the Denisovan signal remains at a constant and fairly low level throughout present-day indigenous populations so far sequenced in both North and South America. The Australasian signal, by contrast, is definitely and notably much stronger among populations in the Amazon, such as the Surui, and much weaker among other Native Americans such as the Arhuaco of non-Amazonian northern Colombia, the Wayuu of non-Amazonian northern Venezuela, the Purupecha of Mexico, and the Ojibwa, Cree, and Algonquin of north and northeast North America. While never reaching the high levels found among Amazonian populations, the signal among Aleutian Islanders and Athabascans is relatively stronger than in other native North American groups, and relatively stronger in Aleutian Islanders than it is in Athabascans. Though Raghavan and Willislev warn in their science paper that the Aleutian Islander data must be interpreted with some caution, since it is heavily masked owing to recent admixture with Europeans. The most parsimonious solution. I next reminded Eske of Skoglund and Reich's papers. In these, as the listener will recall, the authors contemplate the formal possibility that the Australasian signal might reflect a direct settlement of the Amazon by an Australasian-related population that would thus have penetrated deep inside the Americas without mixing with the main ancestral lineage of present-day Native Americans. My question to Professor Willislev, therefore, was whether there was anything in the genetic data that he was aware of that would effectively refute the notion of direct settlement. His reply got straight to the point. Currently, no one has a good explanation of the Australo-Melanesian signal. All that is put forward as possible explanations are purely speculative. So whether it's an old or a later event is unknown. What we do know is that it's present in some Native American groups, particularly from Brazil. We also know it has to be pre-Columbian. We also know that it's not present in any of the ancient skeletons genome sequenced so far. Possible explanations can be, 1. It comes in after the initial peopling of the Americas, for example, by coastal migrations that did not leave much trace behind in contemporary populations. For example, they move quickly. Or that we just haven't sequenced the populations in North America that hold the signal. 2. It's an old migration, through Beringia, before Native Americans, but then it's strange they leave no signals in the ancient skeleton's sequence so far. 3. It's a structured initial Native American population moving south into the Americas, of which some carry the signal, but again, then it's strange that there is no evidence of admixture between the two groups. 4. Someone holding this signal comes into the Americas not through Beringia, but crossing into South America across the ocean. Based purely on the genetic data, this is the most parsimonious explanation, but it doesn't make practical sense. 5. Finally, it's a possibility that the signal is a methodical artifact, that the methods are not behaving as we think they should do. Apart from point 5, which is above my pay grade to assess, it was refreshing to encounter such a straightforward admission that no good explanation has yet been offered for the Australo-Melanesian signal, and such willingness to consider a wide range of possibilities. Since I was already leaning towards the view that the signal is mysterious and might bear witness to a crossing of the Pacific Ocean followed by the settlement in the Amazon of a relatively small group, my eyes were naturally drawn to Eske's point 4, based purely on the genetic data and invoking the parsimony principle, whereby the simplest scientific explanation that fits the evidence is preferred. It looked very much as if this leading figure in the study of ancient genetics agreed with me. Where he and I parted company, however, was over the possibility that anybody could have made an oceanic crossing of thousands of kilometers during the Stone Age. For Eske, such a proposition simply didn't make practical sense. I sent him a follow-up mail to ask if he based his conclusion on the archaeological consensus that our Upper Paleolithic and early Holocene ancestors were incapable of undertaking long transoceanic voyages. He replied, "In regard to crossing the Pacific, I'm not saying it did not happen. But there is no evidence suggesting that humans were capable of such a journey until quite late in history, Polynesian expansion. It's a possibility, and I'm open to the idea, but there's not much evidence supporting it except going for the most parsimonious solution of the genetic data." So here again is a refreshing openness of mind, so rarely seen amongst archaeologists. The best fit for the genetic data does indeed appear to be a trans-Pacific voyage or voyages to South America by a group or groups of settlers carrying Australo-Melanesian genes. However, on the matter of the practicality of anyone undertaking trans-Pacific voyages in the Stone Age, which has to do primarily with the level of technology attributed to our ancestors at that time, Professor Willislev accepts and builds into his own reasoning the mainstream archaeological consensus that there is no evidence suggesting that humans were capable of such a journey until quite late in history. He's not to be blamed for doing so, since it is normal in the sciences for an expert in one field to trust and rely upon the conclusions of experts in other fields. Quite possibly, Professor Willislev is not aware, why should he be, of how little, like a science, archaeology really is, and how often the mainstream archaeological consensus has proved, after suppressing dissenting opinions for decades, to have been fundamentally wrong all along. Recent examples include the hasty and forced addition of more than 5,000 years to the previously accepted chronology for the earliest megalithic sites after the discovery of 11,600-year-old Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, the collapse of Clovis I, and the comprehensive debunking of the long-held belief that the Neanderthals were incapable of art. Clearly, the mainstream archaeological consensus is not always right in what it agrees upon, and it may well turn out that it is not right on the matter of grand oceanic voyages during the Ice Age. Indeed, rather than being ruled out on the basis of a priori assumptions, perhaps that strange Australo-Melanesian genetic signal in the Amazon is part of the proof that such voyages must indeed have occurred. Then there's the matter of the role of the Denisovans in all this. We know from the evidence of Denisova Cave itself that their technology, while undoubtedly Stone Age, was far ahead of its time, and in some ways much more akin to the Neolithic than to the Upper Paleolithic, We know that they could make sea crossings, and that they ranged over a vast area, at least from the Altai Mountains in the west to Australomelanesia in the east. Last but not least, we know that their DNA survives most strongly today in people of Australomelanesian descent, and there's informed speculation that Australomelanesia may have been their original homeland. It's strange and evocative that the mystery of the Denisovans and the mystery of the Australomelanesian genetic signal in the Amazon should collide in this way, and all the more so because, as Eske Willislev makes clear, there's no especially strong Denisovan element in the signal. Perhaps further research will provide us with a higher resolution picture, but from the data presently in hand, it looks like the gene flow to the Amazon involved a population of Australomelanesians who had undergone little or no mixing with Denisovans. For such a people to have existed in the very area where the genetic evidence suggests the Denisovans were most strongly congregated is itself somewhat mysterious and suggests some kind of selective process at work. In previous books, in particular Fingerprints of the Gods and Underworld, I have given extensive consideration to the intriguing phenomenon of ancient maps that show the world as it looked during the last ice age, and do so, moreover, with stunning longitudinal and latitudinal accuracy, and with the use of complex spherical trigonometry. Though it would be superfluous to reproduce here evidence that I have already presented in such detail elsewhere, I include an appendix, Appendix 2, that gives some indication of the richness and the significance of this overlooked material. However many times, by however many hands, they have been copied and recopied down the ages, it is my contention that these anomalous maps can be traced back to lost source documents that could only have originated with a civilization at least advanced enough to have explored the world and to have mapped and measured it when it was still in the grip of the Ice Age. A civilization capable of such feats must, at the very least, have had its own adepts in the techniques of boat building, sailing, navigating, cartography, and geometry, none of these being among the skills that archaeologists are normally willing to attribute to Ice Age hunter-gatherers. It is not inconceivable, however, if such a hypothetical civilization had existed, that it might have sponsored outreach programs to the hunter-gatherers who also lived in the world at that time, just as our own 21st century technological civilization has outreach programs to hunter-gatherers in the Amazon rainforest, the jungles of New Guinea, and the Namibian desert today, anthropologists, aid workers, resettlement experts, and so on and so forth. It's even conceivable that a hypothetical lost civilization of the Ice Age could have had resettlement experts of its own who were interested in the outcomes that might follow from physically removing people from one area, such as Melanesia, for example, and resettling them in far-off places like South America. If a global cataclysm were to loom, threatening the annihilation of the civilization, such outreach initiatives might even have been accelerated to prepare hunter-gatherer populations to serve as refuges for the survivors. This is all pure speculation, of course, but at least it's in good company. As Eske concedes, all of the explanations, including his own, that have so far been offered to account for the presence of Australasian DNA in the Amazon are purely speculative. And the mystery continues to deepen. In November 2018, two major new studies were published, one in the journal Cell, co-authored by Cosimo Poss, David Reich, and others, and the second in Science, co-authored by Eske Willislev, J. Victor Moreno-Meyer, David Meltzer, and others. These new studies found Australasian DNA already present in skeletal remains from Lagoa Santa, Brazil, dated to 10,400 years ago, and confirmed the suspicion of the researchers that the anomalous genetic signal must have reached South America in the late Pleistocene, that is, near the end of the last ice age. How did it get there? Wonders geneticist J. Victor Moreno-Meyer, immediately answering his own question as follows. We have no idea. Similarly, David J. Meltzer expressed amazement at the most peculiar character of the signal, so clearly present in South America, yet somehow leaping over all North America in a single bound. For the purposes of my own quest, however, that anomalous, unexplained signal had the effect of opening up a new and fruitful avenue of inquiry. with the archetypally North American Clovis culture, now known to have South American genetic roots, it was becoming increasingly obvious that to explore the mysteries of one half of the megacontinent, I could not be oblivious to what had happened in the other half. My focus would remain on North America, to which we'll return in part 5, but I had a strong intuition that I might miss an important piece of the puzzle if I failed to investigate the Amazon first. I resented the intuition, which felt like a diversion, but it was so insistent that ultimately I could not ignore it.